now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Well, hello, hello, everybody. Good afternoon to one and all, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding the courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. Every Friday, I am excited to spend this time with you. Every Friday, like I said, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time, and every time in between or elsewhere. And each and every week, these broadcasts that I do really focus on the integration of our spirituality and our mental health, all within the context of our relationships. The relationships that we have with ourselves and others and God or the divine. I am Dr. James Houck, and if you would like to have more information about me, to read up on me a little bit, or to leave me your comments about today's show, I invite you to visit the website. That address is www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. It's all one word. So www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. Okay. And just in case you're not able to spend the entire hour with me this afternoon, or you want to just go back and listen to these broadcasts again, they are indeed podcasted. You can go back through again on the website and go back into the archives and listen to previous shows anytime. Now, if you would like to call in and be a part of today's show, I invite you to call the toll-free line 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And give me your insights and thoughts and comments, observations, your experiences on today's subject, manifesting positive transformations by listening to the heart. Or, in other words, what we think, we manifest. Okay? And we don't necessarily think with our minds alone. Okay? But at any rate, if you are new to the program, I'd like to say welcome aboard. And I'd just like to share, with new listeners, just a little bit about myself, my background, and say that I am indeed just a very sincere believer that all of us come into this world already equipped and graced with everything that we need for in this life, especially in terms of our giftedness or our skills, our talents, our strengths, our character traits, the very, very best parts of ourselves. Because sometimes we need to be reminded of these things. We tend to forget that the very best parts of ourselves are just waiting to come out. Or we think that we know everything there is to know about ourselves, and it's like, well, you ain't seen nothing yet. Okay, but it's unfortunate because of the work that I do in counseling others and as a counseling educator and so forth. Sometimes I just hear and see that, just in humanity in general, as we go along in life and due to some unpleasant experiences, we may tend to hide our giftedness. We do so out of fear. We fear that we're not going to be understood, or we fear we're going to be ridiculed or shamed, or we fear humiliation. And all that negative aspects or that negative perspective of we really have nothing to offer ourselves, let alone anybody else. Or there are some times we go through life and just due to some unpleasant experiences, being in the wrong place at the wrong time, we become wounded, psychologically, physically, emotionally, and even spiritually. And that makes us want to recoil and hide that giftedness, our talents, and our skills because of how they were exploited. Or, you know, we want to, you know, act like, well, no, I don't see it. I don't really have that kind of gift. I don't have that skill. But we know deep inside that we do, but we hide that from others. Again, out of that fear. Or perhaps, you know, growing up, we were told that we would never amount to anything, or whatever other voice we heard telling us that there is nothing special to us. And we bought into that. And we engaged with that, and we just embraced it. And then just going through life, just how that message was reinforced. But actually, that set a distorted template over our perceptions of who we are or what we have or the very best parts of ourselves. That distorted template just clouded the vision of who we truly are. And again, we decided to play small in the world. But as Marianne Williamson reminds us, that when we do play small, when we, you know, diminish the thing, the very best parts of ourselves, it doesn't do anybody any good. Okay, but when we come into the fullness of who we are and fully embrace our giftedness, those are indeed the gifts and graces that everybody benefits from, because they are life-giving. And at any rate, but we, you know, once we are wounded and those wounds get reinforced and so forth, we often go through life, you know, from that wounded perspective, or we slide constantly into victimization, or we play the victim card instead of coming from a place of healing and wholeness and embracing our uniqueness, or a nice word, hachaitas, same thing. And the whole reason why I place this integration of spirituality and mental health in relationships is because when you think about it, we often do receive our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, even spiritual wounds in and through relationships. Because we are relational beings, okay? And just think about the wounds that you have encountered just being in relationships with other people, whether they are within your own family, or maybe they be coworkers or employers or another context. And yet, we can also discover our greatest healing, our strength, peace, forgiveness, and love through healthier relationships. And these relationships, like I said, just might be within our own families or our coworkers and friends. But we can always hold out hope for transformation. And we can always transform and be transformed, you know, through just how we are with ourselves. And we can transform others by our presence, our grace, and our understanding. But first and foremost, forgiveness and the kindness and compassion that we long to seek in relationships has to begin with how we treat ourselves. Because whenever we're compassionate with ourselves, we then can be more compassionate with others. And when we are, you know, more forgiving of ourselves, we then can be more forgiving with others. And when we are able to live in gratitude with ourselves, in that deep, deep gratitude, we then discover how this opens our hearts to see and to live in gratitude with others. It becomes a tangible attribute. It becomes a tangible thing. But transformation begins with us, but it's also meant for the betterment of others. Well, welcome to the last Friday of, or in the month of May, I should say. And here we are coming into Memorial Day weekend. And I once read years ago that, you know, Memorial Day weekend kind of kicks it off, and, you know, for the summer outings and picnics and things like that, even though summer's, you know, not till next month. But, you know, the excitement's in the air. You know, maybe where you are today, the weather is cooperating. Maybe it's not. But as I said, as I read that article, it's also one of the deadliest holidays out there in terms of, you know, fatalities. And, you know, it's interesting when you compare that to 4th of July. 4th of July weekend, that's when you see a spike in the number of people who visit the emergency room, because for some unknown reason, alcohol and fireworks don't mix. But people still engage in that. So anyway, there's a spike in emergency room visits. But with Memorial Day weekend, and, you know, it often turns out to be one of the deadliest for people who are traveling. And that's unfortunate. So I just want to say from the outset, please be aware of your surroundings. Please be careful. You'll eventually get there. No need to speed, because, you know, Memorial Day weekend is very special to many, many people as we remember and honor those who have been killed in the line of duty. And I kind of broaden this myself. I kind of broaden the definition of those who have died in the line of duty to not just include our servicemen and women, by all means, absolutely, but also first responders, police officers, anybody who is part of a rescue team, whatever that is, the people who, unlike the rest of us who want to turn our heads and not look at tragedies, there are people who don't have that luxury, and they do the job because they know how important it is, and they do so in the line of danger. And they come face to face with a lot of experiences that put their lives at risk. So just encourage you to take some time this weekend and just honor and express your gratitude to those who have ultimately given their lives in service to others in this respect, just to honor them in your own way. Well, how many of you have ever heard of the expression, you are what you eat? Okay. I'm sure all of us have. You know, this is something we'll be reminded of, I'm sure, since we're coming into Memorial Day weekend. Okay. But regardless of, you know, this expression, you are what you eat, have you ever heard of another expression? You are what you think. You are what you think. Well, it may not be as popular as you are what you eat, but, you know, one of the most amazing gifts that God has given us is, you know, our minds, the human mind, the ability to learn and to think and to choose and to reason is the essence of what makes us human. Okay. And I remember it was back in the 90s. The 90s were coined the decade of the brain. And a lot of studies were coming out. A lot of research was being done on the brain in terms of its resiliency. And then with the events of 9/11, September 11, 2001, and the massive historical trauma that imposed on many, many people, we started to also understand how the brain handles trauma, as well as intergenerational trauma and so forth. Okay. But, you know, as, you know, getting back to the understanding of the brain, it does, you know, our ability to learn and to think and to choose and to reason does make us human. And while the ability to think makes us human, it actually goes much, much deeper than this. If you were a lover of history, you know that René Descartes, who lived in the early to mid 1600s, he was the first one to write about this concept of emotions in his famous quotation, "I think, therefore I am." And it really clarified his focus on the importance of cognition of the human experience. What do we think about things? How do we perceive things? How do we reflect and so forth? But again, everybody was asking the question, you know, like, well, who are we? You know, how can we like break it down? And Descartes was the first one to say, well, let's see, if I eliminate all things, what I can truly say in this moment is I think and therefore I am. And that was the catchphrase that just stays with us even up to this day. So his work was very influential, you know, even up to how it's taught in today's classrooms. And in psychology, in the world of psychology, Descartes is most known for his concept of dualism, and his writing helped usher in the Age of Reasoning. Now, the Age of Reasoning was slowly gaining traction. It wasn't, you know, full-blown, not until the 1700s, but Descartes' understanding of I think, therefore I am pushed out a little bit further, okay? And so Descartes' theory of dualism suggested that there are two realms of existence, okay? He said first is this physical realm in which the environment and the things around us exist. And he called this the realm of matter and energy. And again, science of his day, the Age of Reasoning, picked up on this and just, you know, said that this realm can be researched. And it is quite scientific because it operates in a very prescribed, methodical, mechanical way. And the other realm, he says, is mental, and it is transcendent to this physical environment, but it cannot be measured. Okay? Now, I tend to disagree with that one because there is more than one way to measure the transcendent. You know, there's more than one way to measure the spiritual effects of, you know, that occurs in individuals, again, all through relationships and our relationship with God or the divine. And so there are ways to measure the spiritual effects other than using, let's say, the standard height, weight, length, whatever, okay? But we can clearly know how a person has been transformed by understanding shifts that occur in their perceptions and thoughts and behaviors, but it's all through the quality of their relationships. I mean, sooner or later, a change is going to show up, and where it shows up first and foremost is how we treat ourselves and how we treat others. Now, true, it doesn't follow the standard, well, how long is that? Or what does that weigh? Or what does that look like? Or, you know, how tall is that? Or you know, it's just that scientific standard, the tools are all wrong for measuring it because it's more of a quality shift in the perceptions, thoughts, and behaviors. And the enhancement of the quality of relationships, which allows people to walk away from something that doesn't make sense in order to, they strongly believe, to take on something better. They want to go and serve others in some capacity. And we're always fascinated by those stories where people seem to walk away from, you know, million-dollar careers in order to get their hands dirty, so to speak, and to serve the underdeveloped, to serve those who have not had the luxury of food or the luxury of certain kinds of energy and so forth, as they're more of developing countries or underdeveloped countries. But at any rate, Descartes' dualism allowed for this separation of sciences and the non-physical realm, which was important in his day because it allowed scientists to conduct their research without fear of being considered heretics by religion. Okay, and all we have to do is invite Copernicus and Galileo to weigh in on that one. You know, I kind of forget who came first. I think it was Copernicus that lived in the 1500s, and both Copernicus and Galileo were considered heretics, and they were both persecuted by the religious groups of their day. But that's for another show, okay? And yet still, let's come back to this question here. There is another dimension to consider when we hear this expression, you are what you think, okay? Well, there's a passage in Scripture that actually comes from the wisdom writings in the Old Testament, in Proverbs, okay, that says, as a person thinks in their heart, so he or she is. As a person thinks in their heart, so he or she is. You know, and we hear that, or we read that, and right away we want to say that the writer got it backwards. you know, shouldn't it be that what we think in our minds, so are we? Well, not quite. Because I think there's a very good reason why the passage is stated the way that it is. Okay? And, you know, this kind of leads us to, you know, go a little bit deeper and saying there's something about this verse that cannot be overlooked. Because who we are on the inside and what we say on the outside sometimes don't always line up. Okay? You know, society would call this person somebody who says they have particular, let's say, moral beliefs, but behaves in a way that those beliefs are not sincere. Okay? And this is actually where the word hypocrite comes from. It's you know, hypocrite is a Greek word, hypokritis, which means an actor or a stage player. And literally, it translated it, it's an interpreter from underneath, which reflects that understanding from, you know, ancient Greece that the actors wore masks and the actors spoke from underneath those masks. So what's going on now? You know, most of us have been taught in school that the heart is just constantly responding to, let's say, orders sent by the brain in form of neurological impulses. Okay. And yet what is not as widely known is that the heart actually sends more signals to the brain than the brain sends to the heart. Okay. It's something that we haven't been taught in school, but it's the research is that's coming out is just fascinating. The heart actually sends more signals to the brain than the brain sends to the heart. And yet these heart signals have a significant effect on brain functioning, you know, influencing emotional processing as well as, you know, let's say the higher cognitive faculties such as our attention span or perceptions, memory, and even problem solving, critical thinking, and so forth. But in other words, not only does the heart respond to the brain, but the brain continually responds to the heart. So, indeed, our thoughts become a reflection of who we really are. Okay, but going back to this, as a person thinks in their heart, so they are. You know, we see in this verse that a person, you know, who might be saying one thing with their mouth, but they're in their heart, they're in a completely different place. And whenever we find ourselves in this, let's say, conundrum, which one do we believe? Do we believe what's in our minds, our brain, or do we believe what's in our hearts? Well, some people go one or the other. And the thoughts and inclinations of the heart really shape the reality of who we are. You know, they shape our thinking, which ultimately shapes our actions. And that's why when you think about what matters, it's forming the basis of who you will become. However, we're also encouraged to have our hearts and minds be in sync with one another. You know, this is something that I see in many clients that some people are either all in their emotions and they just have a hard time, you know, going up to their head. Because, you know, just the rational reasoning they don't want to do, they don't trust it. And vice versa. Some people are all in their, you know, cognitions, all in their head, and they don't trust their emotions. And so being able to bring that down into the heart is just something that's totally foreign to them. Okay? But this understanding of, you know, that the heart sends more signals to the brain than the brain sends to the heart actually has become very prominent, you know, all due to the findings from the researchers from the Heart Math Institute. And you can look them up online. I think it's just heartmathinstitute.com or something like that. And, you know, through their research, they say that, you know, at times during stress and negative emotions, this is when the heart rhythm pattern is erratic and disordered. and the corresponding pattern of neural signals traveling from the heart to the brain actually inhibits higher cognitive functions, you know, such as attention, perception, memory, problem solving, and so forth. And the heart's input to the brain during stressful or negative emotions also has a profound effect on the brain's emotional processes. I mean, actually serving to reinforce the emotional experience of stress. Okay, and this, you know, certainly when we're under a lot of stress, this will, you know, begin to take its toll on our immune system. Okay, and so clearly being in negative, negative, negative all the time with our thoughts weakens the physical body and its ability to fight off bacteria or the ability to fight off, let's say, the common cold or something like that. Okay, but it also limits our ability to think clearly and to remember or to learn or reason or make effective decisions. And this also helps explain why we may often act impulsively or unwisely or rashly when we're under stress, because we react out of our sympathetic nervous system. It's that fight or flight, you know, where we're just in survival mode and we're not thinking rationally. Okay. But after a perceived threat or danger has passed, we then shift over into the parasympathetic nervous system, where we're able to calm down, and that's when we can reflect. That's when we can think clearly, and so forth. But let me ask you one other question, as we're going to take this notion of the heart communicating with the mind or the brain. How many times have you walked by somebody and felt a certain negative vibe? Or you're sitting near people who are, let's say, just very happy, just expressively happy, and you feel a certain lift in your emotions. Okay? And it's very common, so I'm sure we all have. Well, Roland McCratty from the Heart Math Institute, he's done studies on this, and he writes that the heart, like the brain, generates a powerful electromagnetic field, an energy field, which can be measured several feet away from a person's body, or we may call that the aura. And it can be actually felt between two individuals in close proximity. Okay, and I mean, it's not just what's going on with the other person, but the same thing could be true with us. I mean, without realizing it, our electromagnetic field, our energy field, gives off that kind of information when we are angry and fearful or depressed or experiencing some other negative emotion, as well as when we have empathy or compassion, gratitude or love, or when we experience something positive. But they always, you know, the age-old saying is that dogs can smell fear. And it's like, well, that's true, because we are giving off that kind of energy where we are afraid. We might be terrified or whatever. But again, dogs can also smell empathy, compassion, gratitude, and love. That's why you just watch dogs around other people, and immediately, as they get close, they start wagging that tail. Okay, they are like little barometers when it comes to, you know, human emotions or our human energy field. But, you know, this vibe, this energy field goes even deeper. You know, it's just amazing. It just keeps going and going and going. Because in another study from the Heart Math Institute, it was a study entitled The Heart-Brain Synchronization Between Mother and Baby. I think it came out somewhere around like 2008, 2009. But the researchers there, they studied the energetic heart-brain interactions, as they called it, that occur between a mother and her infant. And the researchers were able to show that a mother's brain waves synchronized to that of her baby's heartbeat. In other words, it appears that when the mother placed her attention on the baby, that she became more sensitive to the very subtle electromagnetic signals generated by the infant's heart. I mean, it's just fascinating, you know. And this is why, you know, looking at things from, like, say, a human developmental standpoint, the first 2 years, and even prior to that, but especially the first 2 years of a child's life, that bonding, that trust, that you know, all those, you know, positive attachment is so crucial, because how we've bonded with our caregiver or caregivers, or how we've attached with our caregivers, certainly determines how we form relationships as we get older. Is there a sense of trust there? Or is there a sense of mistrust? You know, how comfortable are we being around others? Okay, and babies are another group that really sensitive to what's going on around them, because it's all based on touch. And they, you know, what we feel, and we all went through this too when we were that age, you know, what we feel or have felt back then stays with us. You know, in other words, we know when we felt safe. We knew actually who was holding us, and when it didn't feel comfortable to be held for one reason or another. Okay. So, just again, fascinating research that's coming out of the HeartMath Institute. And like I said, you can look them up on the internet. Just they're doing very, very solid work. Okay. Well, I would really love to hear your heart on these matters so far. So again, if you'd like to call in, the number is 888-627-6008, 888-627-6008, and I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I am your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, I just want to share a word about next week's show. Next Friday at 3 Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Time. Next week actually highlights for me a special one-year anniversary episode that I have been on the air, that I've been doing these broadcasts. And I have to say that year flew by. And I just want to thank all of you for following along with me this past year. And I'll be sharing some news more next week, and the website and so forth, about how you can continue supporting this program through opportunities to subscribe. But I want to get more information into your hands, so stay tuned. Well, at any rate, next week, June 4th, as I said, that special one-year anniversary episode, I'll be starting off my second year with BBS Radio by having more conversations, you know, pertaining to the integration of our mental health and our experiences within third, fourth, and fifth dimensions of spirituality. And some of these topics are going to include, you know, how and why we're triggered by certain events in the world. And what do we actually sense in our soul, or we sense in our spirit? When having a more intentional progression in our spirituality, as well as how then do we find that courage once and for all to let go of the non-life-giving perceptions and experiences that we've had in order to take on more of our authentic selves. So invite you to tune in next Friday afternoon and listen to The Alchemy of Our Authenticity. Okay. Well, earlier in the show, I've been talking about how most of us have been taught in school that the heart is constantly responding to the, the orders, shall we say, sent by the brain in the form of neurological impulses. Okay, so a good example of this would be, let's say we smell a flower, which is picked up by, in the brain, the thalamus and the hippocampus, which in turn sends signals throughout the rest of our body to respond or to react according to a previous memory of flowers. We look at its shape, we look at the color, we smell it, and so forth. If it makes a noise when we, happen to, either drop it, let's say inadvertently, or the stem breaks or something like that. We take all that in through our senses. And yet, what goes on more is perhaps the heart is sending more signals to the brain at that time than the brain is sending to the heart. And again, this is the, from the Heart Math Institute, just again, fascinating. And these heart signals have a significant effect on brain function and influencing, the emotional processing, as well as, the higher cognitive faculties, such as our problem-solving skills or critical thinking skills or our perception and short-term, long-term memory and so forth. So, in other words, not only does the heart respond to the brain, but the brain continuously responds to the heart. And as I mentioned before the break, Roland McCratty from the Heart Math Institute has done a lot of study in this area, and he really focused on how the heart, like the brain, generates this powerful electromagnetic field or an energy field. And this is something that can be measured several feet away from a person and can actually be seen with two people who are standing close to each other. And this is something that we also give off as well. Whenever we're angry or fearful or depressed or, experiencing some other kind of negative emotion, as well as, empathy and compassion and gratitude or love, or whenever we experience something positive. Okay. But, one of the things that I have just been totally fascinated with as the more and more that I read and go through the research on the Heart Math Institute is that, through these studies, there's also evidence to suggest that our social interactions have the potential to affect all relationships, okay? But especially to our ancestors through our soul connection. And again, my ears perked up when I said that, or my heart did a little pitter-patter, because it's like, if you've been listening to these shows all along, I am all about healing intergenerational trauma. And what does that look like, and how do we do that? Because, again, I also believe that we have that blood-soul connection with those who have come before us, as well as having a blood-soul connection to those who will come after us. Okay. And healing intergenerational trauma calls for us to deal with both ourselves and others in a compassionate manner. And it doesn't matter if we've never met our ancestors, or we have no idea who lived 1,000 years ago or whatever. It's not that at all, And again, if you've been, listening all this time, that one of my favorite object lessons is, if we just prick our finger and we look at our blood, there they are. They are already with us as far as the DNA that has been handed down, as and the positive traits and not so good DNA, or you don't label it as good or bad, but some things that we have to deal with as well. as you know, not just genetically, but also what's been taught, handed down behaviorally, what has changed, what has kind of like landed in our laps. Okay. But, you know, as we trace our ancestral, let's say our ancestral wounds back to generations who also suffered horrors and injustices, it's not really a matter of placing blame at their feet, whether they are distant or more recent, for what they passed down to us. Because it's true, you know, each soul is accountable for their lifetime here on Earth. And yet, the purpose in listening to our ancestors is to first and foremost acknowledge this blood and soul connection we have with them. And when we're able to do so, we not only honor their lives, but we also find ourselves sowing these seeds of compassion and understanding and peace in every and all things. But this listening to our ancestors, do we listen with our minds, our brains, or can we listen with our hearts and souls? Because our ancestors may not have been psychologically or physically or emotionally or spiritually strong enough to heal and transform their trauma, but we are. And I can say that with all reassurance because, again, I tend to believe that our ancestors look to us now because we are the ones who can transform family trauma because we're aware of it. You know, and I've shared before that whenever I introduce this subject to kids or teenagers, you know, they've never heard this before because they're often looked at as the problem in the family. You know, they're often looked at as the black sheep of the family, or, you know, if you can just get your act together. And, you know, a lot of the conversations I have with parents is, you know, first of all, don't blame the child. Maybe the child's just reacting to something else going on in the family. We don't know yet, but let's take a look at that. Okay. But as I explain to the child or the teenager that they are actually the strongest one in the entire family line to be able to not only heal this trauma, but also to keep it from going forward, they sit up, they pay attention, they get a big smile on their face because perhaps for the first time in their life, they feel empowered. They feel like, oh, so wait a minute, I'm not the problem. I'm actually the solution. And it's like, yeah, you've never considered that before. And they do. It's like, okay, let's go to work. Let's get this done. And then, you know, just listening to the stories and let's go back through, let's say ancestry.com or one of his other genealogy sites to, you know, to kind of get like the historical times in which your ancestors lived. But let's also have a conversation with grandma or grandpa, or depending on how young the child is, maybe their great grandmother or great grandfather, you know, because when you get into the grandparents, they also come with the memories of two and three generations. So we could have stories and just an understanding of what was coming down through the family, you know, with six, seven, maybe even eight generations of that understanding. Okay. And, you know, like I said, I believe that, you know, they may not have been strong enough, or maybe they had to do what they had to do. You know, again, going back and healing intergenerational trauma is not about finding fault. It's about finding what can be healed, what can be transformed. Because those who have yet to be born, who we always have this blood-soul connection with, they're depending on that. Perhaps they would look back on the times which we lived and just say, thank you. I see something that was coming down through the generations and all of a sudden it disappeared. It healed. Where'd it go? It doesn't really matter where it went. It's just that generations are not having to deal with it. Okay? So regardless of how we try to make sense of the intergenerational trauma phenomena, our ancestors do speak to us. You know, the more we come into our own awareness of soul consciousness, the more fully we can embrace our truth, that we have everything that we need to transform negative and harmful energies of dysfunctional systems by our actions that stand on truth, understanding, compassion, forgiveness, gratitude, and love. You know, these traits are no longer to be treated as mere buzzwords spoken in, let's say, certain educational or political or even religious venues. But rather, once we develop and integrate and anchor these positive characteristics in our lives, they become powerful forces that transmute others from their hidden, voiceless pain and suffering into liberated souls, no longer bound by traumatic experiences. You know, indeed, ours is an experiential relationship with God, and therefore that urges us to embrace others as they have and will continue to experience life. And therefore, in seeking to heal from our own intergenerational wounds, I believe we have to first recognize and remove these, you know, these distorted templates that have been laid over, you know, of our perceptions, you know, let's say some like from society's mirror, in order to do so for the rest of humanity. And we have to call, you know, negativity for what it is, and look at these distortions and just how they have just kept people in very wounded, painful places for centuries and centuries and centuries. Okay. Well, as I said, the heart actually sends more signals to the brain than the brain sends to the heart. Okay, and it does have a significant effect on how the brain functions. Okay, but let's take this understanding a little bit deeper by taking a closer look at how thoughts really manifest themselves in our lives, positive and negative. Okay, well, we often believe that our emotions, as I said a couple of weeks ago, we often believe that our emotions are the enemy. You know, people who are uncomfortable with sharing emotions or experiencing their emotions, they're just like, no, 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 no. You know, we either want to run from them or hide them, or we've been told in some way, shape, or form not to trust our emotions. You know, and I usually say, you know, I see this very clearly when it comes to helping people overcome addictions, is that, you know, we need to understand first and foremost that, you know, in addictions and addictions recovery, that people either want to feel something or they want to feel nothing. And this is where the addiction comes in. You know, they might be so shut down emotionally that they can't feel unless something artificial is in their system. Or perhaps they've gone through something horrific and traumatic and they just don't want to feel that. And so having that artificial substance or whatever the addiction is, in order to quell that, in order to not feel that, even for just a moment, is worth it. However, it really keeps us from labeling our emotions, you know, being, you know, positive. But for some reason, you know, we need to heal from those negative emotions. We need to heal from that trauma because it's the addictions. Again, it is clouding all that, whether we want to feel something or we want to feel nothing. And, you know, in the cases of, like, say, depression or anxiety, you know, again, let's call it for what it is and what it does to us. You know, we're either pulled into our past because of previous psychological, emotional, physical, even spiritual wounds. And as a result, we fear being wounded again in the future. So we're either pulled into the past or we're constantly being pulled into the future. But either way, these extremes keep us from being fully present with ourselves and, of course, with others. And it's true. Our thoughts manifest various things for us. But these thoughts do not solely come from the mind. They also come from our hearts. I mean, the head and the heart and the head are constantly talking to each other. But how many times do we catch ourselves often wanting to stay in one or the other? I mean, think about it. I mean, rarely do we allow ourselves to trust ourselves to sync the two together? Do we? I mean, most of the time, our minds are just racing all over the place. You know, even when we engage in meditation, you know, because like, well, I need more meditation in my life. I need to find peace. I just need to quiet myself. And yet, when we engage in that, we find that our minds are just jumping all over the place. And this is something that the Buddhists refer to this phenomena as the monkey mind. Always busy, always going here or there, always looking around, and this huge fear of missing out that is just hanging over our heads. Yeah. And as a result of this monkey mind, it's nearly impossible to slow down and enjoy just being present. And in addition, just all the negativity that comes at us from any given moment, any given day, any given week, any given month, any given year, certainly affects our mood. You know, it makes us unhappy or angry or restless or anxious. It hampers our ability to concentrate. It has a negative impact on our behavior, and it interferes with our ability to have positive interactions with others. And as I said, you know, we already know that kind of negativity and stress weaken the immune system. But yet, we continue to ruminate on the past, thinking that, somehow if we can go, you know, jump into Mr. Whoopi's time machine, go back there with, you know, Mr. Peabody, we can go back into the past, and that we would be better off, if we could just simply change the past, we'd be better off in the present, and then therefore we wouldn't have to worry about the future. But that's not possible. However, when we engage the heart, we ground, we find stillness, we can find peace, we get out of that monkey mind, and by doing so, our hearts send signals to our minds to rethink, so to speak, and to transform. And when we were able to do this with great consistency, engaging the heart first, we no longer wish to find peace. We no longer wish to find grace. We no longer wish to have love or to find love, but rather we become peace. We become grace. We become love. And talk about changing the vibe we give off. This sense of beingness generates a powerful, positive energy field and a very vibrant R. And other people can pick up on this even before we speak. And therefore, we don't have to worry about what we're going to say in any given situations. We can just simply be. And then we can allow ourselves to be fully present with whatever the situation requires. But our negativity bias, as another person had put it, it means that we spend too much time ruminating over those minor frustrations. You know, it just could be, you know, we were sitting in a traffic jam, or maybe we had a disagreement with a loved one, and we ignore the many chances to experience that, the wonder, the grace, and simply living in gratitude throughout the day. How much do we miss just by being caught up in negativity? And I know what perhaps some people are saying out there. They might believe that this, sounds too good to be true. It's so idealistic. It's not possible in this lifetime to achieve. But the fact is, we have everything we need to be able to live authentically by simply incorporating four statements into our lives every day. Ira Byock would call these things saying the four things that matter the most. I call it finding our true selves through being in right relationships. Either way, transformation occurs. saying the four things that matter the most. Forgive me for, I forgive you for, thank you for, I love you because. You want to change the mind and stop manifesting negativity in your life? Focus on forgiveness, gratitude, and love, and bring them into your heart. With ourselves first, and then with others. But saying these things is not a matter of the mind. Instead, it's saying these things take us directly into our hearts. And we can find tremendous, tremendous healing. Forgive me. I forgive you. Thank you. I love you. The greatest effect hearing the cries from our ancestors has on us not only comes from getting in touch with our own soul's voice and how we live in forgiveness with ourselves, and gratitude with ourselves, and the love of ourselves, but it also awakens us to hear the cries of those who have no voice today. Who forgives them? Who shows them gratitude? Who loves them? We're all beautiful souls made in the image of God, full of inherent value, dignity, and worth. And yet we may struggle to accept this truth because our attention is often diverted to focus solely on outward appearances and behaviors. And before you know it, negative, negative, negative starts to come in. We all live with some degree of awareness or ignorance of our soul consciousness. Yeah, we get glimpses of it, but we never attain the full extent because the physical, emotional, psychological issues that we're dealing with often cloud our vision of who we truly are. You know, diseases and illnesses do afflict us in the body. We do feel physical and emotional, psychological, even spiritual pain with so much intensity at times that we believe it's going to break us in two. And at times, our lungs might struggle to take a breath, or hunger and diseases cause our stomach and intestines and bones and muscles and blood to scream in agony. And these experiences might make us question whether or not we are the soul whom God has created. And yet this illusion lies not in the suffering and pain and agony we experience, but rather it's in our perception that there's nothing more to us than just an emotional, intellectual, and physical body. You know, indeed, physical and emotional pain and suffering can temporarily drown out the cry of the soul, but our soul is never silenced. And once the soul has found its voice, look out. It'll never be silenced again. And the truth is that the greatest strength of who we are as souls lies in our ability to transform and transcend the physical, emotional, psychological limitations. For as much as history has shown us the horrific crimes of humanity and what people have done to themselves and vice versa, there are just as many stories out there of humanity rising above such tragedies to heal and reclaim the soul. So are we ready to do the work? Well, if we are, then let us continue to listen to our hearts and manifest the positive, life-giving experiences that lift each other up to reach the heights of our authentic selves. I'm Dr. James Houck, and invite you to tune in next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Time, for that special one-year anniversary show. But until that time, have a good weekend. Enjoy Memorial Day. Remember those who have given the ultimate sacrifices. Express your gratitude and love for them. And please, please be careful. Take care, and God bless. Ooh.
for an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Hauk. It's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific Time on PBS Radio TV.